I'm chatting this afternoon with Professor Ken Hillman, who is the Professor of Intensive Care at the University of New South Wales. He's also written a new book called A Good Life to the End. Professor Hillman, thank you very much for your time this morning.
A pleasure.
Why did you feel the need to write your book?
Well, if you compare what it was like when we first started intensive care in the early 80s, when most of our patients were young and had potentially reversible diseases, gradually and incrementally over the last 30 years or so, we've got older patients, and many of them are near the end of life. It just kept up on us fairly gradually, and we didn't notice it until the last couple of years, I guess. It's just more related to issues such as societal expectations. Each day we hear about medical miracles, about this and that, and so when we have these patients, even very elderly patients, 80 and 90 years of age, they have the impression, and so do we somewhat as well, that we can keep people alive indefinitely. And of course we can keep people alive. We hadn't thought through really well what chances this person got at getting out of hospital alive. And if they get out of hospital alive, what are their chances of not being alive, just naturally and normally coming to the end of their life within the next couple of months? And it's very, very high.
Is the expectation rise within the patients themselves, or is it within the people around them, their families, their doctors?
It's not the only factor. There's this drive, this sort of conveyor belt. If you get sick sort of at home or in the community somewhere, then we immediately call for help. We call an ambulance. Ambulance takes you to the emergency department. Emergency department packages you rapidly, because that's what they're meant to do, as you to bring you into hospital rather than conduct the complex conversations. You need to turn somebody around and get cared for in the community. And then you have doctors who are programmed to make people better, and the whole medical course is about how we save lives. And so one has all these other factors as well going on. It's the whole culture. And it's really hard to pluck people off that conveyor belt. Even if they're demented, even if they're from a nursing home, even if it's not perhaps what they would have wanted when they were conscious and able to make decisions.
There's a phrase you use early on, actually in the introduction, I think, to your book, where you say that there's satisfaction in orchestrating a good dying process. What makes a good dying process?
Well, that's really strange, because we weren't really taught about this when we trained as intensive care clinicians. It wasn't in any books or journals. And so we sort of talked to each other about it. And most of us now say that it is very satisfying. So what actually makes it satisfying? I guess it's to see people who don't suffer, who aren't in pain, who, when you've made the decision that there's not really anything more that modern medicine can offer, that they're allowed to die with dignity. So it's not only from the patient's perspective, then when one conducts complex sort of communications with the relatives, and even though they're sad and even though they're crying, they also have a sense of relief. So it's all of these things. It's a patient not suffering, it's relatives where you've been honest and straightforward, and they're very satisfied with it. And we often get more letters saying thank you for what we've done with the dying process than we do for thank you for saving such and such's life.
Do we understand the concept of frailty?
Look, it's only been in the last couple of years that we've been talking about this concept. And I must say, I find it very fascinating. Up until now, we've defined a patient's illness according to our sort of measurements, biochemical abnormalities, they've got a high blood pressure, low blood pressure, whatever. And so this is for the first time, it's defining a person's level of illness and their prognosis, if you like, according to their own sort of characteristics. And if any of us have got a sort of elderly relative, then we often talk about how they've become frailer. So we've sort of latched onto this word, and we're putting more sort of accurate scores around it. If we sort of start out our conversation by saying things such as, have you noticed a difference in the last 12 months with, you know, how fast they can walk and how quickly they get around and their grip strength and things like that? They actually know what you're talking about immediately compared to like complex biochemical analyses and whatever.
How important is it for a person's own doctor to be advocating for things like advanced care planning, having these difficult conversations with your relatives, with your elderly relatives, or if you're elderly, with your family? How do we get that culture more ingrained into our general practice culture?
I think the key for all of this is the GP. By the time they've come into hospital, then they have all these expectations that hospitals have got this incredible equipment to keep people alive forever. And I know that most GPs are very suspicious of that, and they really don't think that we can do much for the 90-year-old demented person anyway. They actually haven't got the confidence to know what we can and, more importantly, what we can't do in hospitals. And so really they're pressured as well to put the person into hospital, even though they don't, even though they're probably pretty cynical about what we can and what we can't do. So they're not empowered to make this choice either. But the key is empowering people to talk to their GPs, write these things down in the form of the advanced care directives, of course.
Physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia is a huge topic of debate. Where does the ICU and ICU specialists, where do they fit into that debate, and how does that change things for intensivists?
It's a very different but very subtle difference. When we withhold or withdraw treatment in someone where to continue treatment is futile is very different from sort of euthanasia, which is more about sort of deliberately taking someone's life. So I don't really talk about that as a separate issue as far as I'm concerned. However, it's very similar in that what I'm saying in the book is that we need to sort of empower people to make their own choice about how they're going to conduct their end-of-life experience. So it's very similar in that way.
The other big debate that seems to be happening, particularly around medical education, is the need perhaps to retool medical education towards generalism. We've had this big push towards specialties and subspecialties. What's your view on generalism in terms of how, again, empowering GPs, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Look, it's really strange, but over the last 20 years, then the population in the community and the population in hospitals has changed remarkably. So we've built our health system in hospitals around separate organs. So this was from an era where a young, otherwise well person got a single organ problem, like they had a heart attack or they had an appendix or tonsils out or they've got this disease or that disease, which is really well defined. Now, things have changed radically. Most of the people that come into hospital now are sort of over the age of 65, and most of them have age-related chronic conditions, which we talk about in medical terms. But in fact, most of them are age-related deterioration. So you get these comorbidities like type 2 diabetes, ischemic heart disease, a bit of dementia, weight loss sort of thing. And so this sort of person comes in the hospital, and then it's random how we sort of allocate them to a specialist. They've got a whole lot of diseases, and then they come in with something like a urinary tract infection or a fall. Now, who do you put that person under? Well, this actually drives people in the emergency department mad. And so to have our hospitals divided up along organ roles no longer makes any sense whatsoever. And if you look at what's happened in Europe, the UK, North America, they've gone away from that.
You are one of the pioneers of the medical emergency team. Do we do that well in Australia?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm really proud to say that we do it better than anywhere in the world. And I guess that's because we've had it longer. So, for example, we've sort of reduced the cardiac arrest rate to less than 1 per 1,000 admissions, world's best practice. But there was also something very interesting that happened with the MET system, and we hadn't thought about this at all, but we were being called, in fact, one third of all of our calls, according to a big study that was done in Melbourne, were for people who were at the end of life. Now, that's really fascinating. That's one third of all the cases, and we get maybe 8-9 calls per day in a big teaching hospital. Then, when one multiplies that throughout Australia, and indeed throughout the world, because the study was multi-center international, that's one hell of a lot of people who aren't recognized as being at the end of life. Most of them are old.
If a MET team is called to the bedside of a 90-year-old in cardiac arrest, what's the thinking as compared to a 60-year-old?
I speak on behalf of my own team when they go out. They are so frustrated when there's someone who's obviously at the end of their life. Nobody's spoken to them. Nobody's stood back from their own organ and put it all together, like the sum of the chronic conditions, and said, look, what the heck are we doing? Because we're only very marginally sort of improving, one organ's function, if at all. But this gets back to your specialist, concept that, that if you're highly specialised, it's very difficult for you to stand back and look at how these ageing organs all interact with each other.
How do we change this, Ken? Because, every specialty's got its agenda. They're all looking after, rightly so, looking after their own patients, looking after their own specialties.
You can, in theory, say, let's go back to medical education and let's teach medical students. But really, there aren't many advocates for this approach. It's still dominated by medical specialists here that dominate the medical education system. My approach, basically, is very similar to the MET system, where you sort of recognise elderly frail people who haven't got long to live, and we're doing that. We've developed a tool for that. And then once we've flagged these people, then we have a far more appropriate response. So we're just about to embark on this large study where people who come into the emergency department, once they're flagged by a score, if you like, by a tool, as being someone who's got less than a year to live, bearing in mind that there's uncertainty, like there always is with medicine, then that's time at least to have a discussion with that person and their carers, and then to sort of empower them to make their own choices about future management. So that's a fairly long-winded way of saying that I sort of believe that we need to involve society in it, and that's one of the reasons why I've written the book.
Are we teaching our doctors how to have these conversations?
No, we aren't. And again, if you look at specialties such as geriatric, they're actually much better than the average specialist clinician. They're still programmed to think of diseases. Many of them don't like saying this is only because of your age. They don't want to be seen as a marginalised specialty. That doesn't believe in medically helping people in the traditional sense of the word. Care is another aspect where there's hope, but at the moment they're still looking at diseases such as cancer, heart failure, COPD. I'm not too sure whether frail old people are on their agenda too much at the moment. We think we're doing world-shattering research at Liverpool Hospital now along these lines, a little bit like the MET system, to sort of establish a different way of approaching elderly frail people who may be near the end of life. So that we're honest with them, we're transparent, and then we offer them a lot more choices. And I think that could become as well known as the MET system.
The book's called A Good Life to the End, Taking Control of Our Inevitable Journey Through Ageing and Death by Professor Ken Hillman. And it's out on the 28th of June, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. Ken, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.